Well, maybe turn to the prophecy of Daniel in chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2, and reading at verse 40, "And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces, and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces, and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay, and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, forasmuch as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron as part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. May God bless the reading of his word." About 20 years ago, I suppose it was, I was in Brussels. I had a little team there to negotiate a research agreement. And we took a terribly long time that day. I began to wonder whether I was ever going to get to lunch. But finally we settled and agreed on the terms. Then the whole party just seemed to dissolve. My officer number took me off to lunch. As we were entering his club, he turned to look at the car. He said, "Look there." Well, I don't know whether I was too overcome by that time, but I could see nothing strange about the car. And I said so. He said, "Well, look at the number plate. In a very short space of time, you'll find number plates of that kind all over Western Europe." Well, he was rather wrong, as a matter of fact. He wasn't aware, of course, that General de Gaulle was going to give instructions. The French car should only bear one distinguishing letter, and that's the letter F. But in general, he was right. Over the luncheon table, he started talking about another meeting that was going on in another part of the city, where another Englishman, Edward Heath, was trying to negotiate another agreement entirely. He was quite rude over lunch, in fact. He said there was not the slightest possibility of any agreement being reached. And he was rather rude in the way he put it and the arguments he used. And as he was paying for the lunch, I couldn't say very much. But when I left him, I took the train down to France, where my son lives. He came up to the borders to meet me at Tournai. And as Englishmen usually do, we turned to the nearest restaurant.
"Please turn the tape over at this point."
And as Englishmen usually do, we turned to the nearest restaurant. He had coffee, being a Frenchman, or practically a Frenchman. He knew the right thing to do. I ordered tea. The darkest thing imaginable. Never order tea in France. If you do, well, your blood be upon your own head. Anyhow, there we sat, and presently my son said, "Look at that television screen." Well, he's bigger than I am, so I always follow his advice. I looked, and presently upon the screen, there's a picture of a very, very tall man, with a curious-shaped nose. And all I remember from that interview he had was one word, the French word, "no." He posed rhetorical question after rhetorical question. And to everyone, he gave the same reply, "no." What he was saying virtually was the same as my Belgian friend had said over the lunch table. That Britain was too insular, she was not really of continental spirit, and she was quite undesirable as a member of the European community. And General de Gaulle put it quite plainly on the television screen that afternoon. Since that time, of course, Britain has become a member. And at the end of this year, another country will be added to that community. So that on the 1st of January 1981, there'll be 10 nations in membership of the European Community. Anyway, so that's all very interesting, but so what? Well, pause for a moment or two and realise some of the implications. 10 countries have come together with one specific purpose, to form an integrated whole. It started off with the European Coal and Steel Community back in 1951. After that, the European Atomic Energy Community and at the same time, the European Economic Community. Each of those communities had its own commission and its own president. Today they have been merged into one. So there is one community covering all aspects, one commission and one president. In the hands of the commission, there is a tremendous amount of authority and power. And ultimately, supreme power is held in the hands of the president. There is a European Parliament, a more marvellous talking shop than our Westminster Parliament. There is no power attached to that Parliament whatsoever. The only thing they can do is to approve or disapprove the budget. If they disapprove, it comes back in another form, so they have to approve. That's the limit of their authority. The full executive authority is held in the hands of the Commission. And that is composed of commissioners appointed by the various countries that are members of the community. The power really lies in their hands. They formulate proposals and decide policy. Some of their proposals are submitted to the European Parliament. Whether the Parliament agrees or not, the proposals are implemented by the commissioners. And ultimately, of course, the final decision, if need there is for one, is taken by the President of that commission. So there are really a tremendous amount of power is held in his hand. There is an intention not merely to integrate those countries economically, and of course you'll realize what that has implied in the past and still does. All trade barriers are stripped away between the members of the community, and there's one common tariff, one common trade barrier against all other nations. So that imports into any one of those 10 countries bear the same rate of duty in each of the countries. There is one policy, one integrated whole in the matter of trade and industry. But it goes farther than that. The ultimate intention is that the president of the community shall have complete power in the rationalization of industry. That means quite simply, not merely that he will approve modern techniques and processes, but also that he will have power to decide where industry shall be carried on. If, for example, and I'm choosing a British example, he decided that all textiles should be manufactured in Luxembourg, a physical impossibility, of course, he could close down all the factories in other countries and transfer the work to Luxembourg. Where the work goes, quite obviously, capital must follow, so that he virtually has control of capital and its will. Where work and capital go, quite patently, labour must also follow. So that he virtually has control of labour also. In fact, under the Treaty of Rome, there is provision for a secretariat for trade unions. That has already been set up. And the intention is that every worker shall belong to his appropriate organisation. Every manual worker, for example, to his trade union. Every professional worker to his professional organization. And it would be quite impossible in a coming day and in the not too distant future for anyone to get secure a job unless he's a member of his appropriate body. Additionally, all employers who are virtually under the control of the community itself, under the control of the Commission. The workers' federations will have to secure permission from the central authority to establish new factories and to employ labour. And ultimately, a complete control of trade and industry will be in the hands of the Commission, and ultimately, of course, in the hands of the one man who is president. It goes even farther than that. not only economically and industrially, not only in the realm of commerce, but in every other realm as well, the intention is a full integration. It has been said quite frankly, we can no longer have 9 different foreign policies, or as it will be next year, 10. There must be 1 foreign policy, so that not only from other points of view, but politically as well, there will be a full integration. That means, of course, quite simply, that some of the powers held by various nations and various parliaments will be restricted. Laws that are passed by the European Parliament or by some other body, or instructions that are given by the European Communities Commission, must be obeyed by the member countries. And that body does override the national governments. And ultimately, the national government's powers will be restricted to a very great extent. That is, quite clearly, a surrender to some extent of national sovereignty to a supranational power. There has been quite a lot of discussion about that. The end is perfectly simple and definitely sure. And in the foreseeable future, there will be a recognition of a superpower to which all other nations within the community will have to pay homage in some shape or form. I don't mean religious homage, but practical homage. So you can see the picture for me. A community of 10 nations acting as one integrated whole. It has a tremendous purchasing power. Its imports are 10 times those of the USSR and over twice as much as the imports of the USA. Its exports are on the same kind of scale. So there is a tremendous value in belonging to that body. In my country, there are certain arguments today over the desirability of membership or of withdrawing from membership. But the plain fact is that having become a member is going to be almost totally impossible to remove ourselves from that membership. The financial obligations and the entanglement is so awfully complicated that to enter or to withdraw creates a tremendous number of problems today. So that it has been said quite frankly by the authorities, no more full members. 10 full members, and the entrance of Greece at the end of the year has created so many financial problems that they're fairly firm upon this. 10 full members and no more. There may well be associate members like Spain and Portugal. But for full membership, it seems the door now is pretty tightly closed. So here's a community of 10 countries with a commission with full executive authority and the president in whose hands ultimately resides the full power to decide what should be done and what decisions shall be taken. In the foreseeable future, his authority will be even greater than is visualized at the moment. Realize again some of the implications. Everyone must belong to his appropriate body. Employees to their appropriate organizations. Employers to their appropriate federations. And so on. It will be impossible to buy or sell, using biblical language, unless one has the approval of the central authority. It's remarkably like some of the things described in the Bible. Now don't go away presently and say, I said that the European Commission or the European Community was what is described in the Bible. For I have said no such thing. All I'm saying is, this is an illustration of what the Bible describes and might one day be very close indeed to what is described therein. The Bible does talk about a collection of nations, 10 in number. Not only the passage from which we have read, but also in the book of Revelation as well. The whole thing is portrayed in different fashions. There's no mistaking what is implied. Revelation 17 says quite clearly 10 kings, or 10 kingdoms, and refers to another as exercising complete authority over the 10. If we had turned to Daniel chapter 7, We'll have found a curious feat here. There it says, the man who ultimately takes control of the 10 nations commences by taking authority over 3. 3 voluntarily give their power into his hand. Let the other 7 recognize him as overlord. Now pause and think of what is occurring today. And again, may I take an illustration and take it from the European community. In that community, there are 3 nations which earlier worked closely together. They are Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg. Because of the similarity of their economic and financial problems, they are discussing the desirability of working closely together again, under the aegis, of course, of the community. If a man were to arise who is capable of solving their problems and dealing with their current difficulties, there's no question at all. They would give their authority to that man. And were that to occur, the other 7 countries unquestionably would be only too ready to hand their authority to him also. So that what Daniel 7 declared, sent to the girl, is finding a reflection in what is happening at our present day. Again, I say, don't say I said this was that. I'm just using an illustration. But look at the picture again. One man with almost supreme control. That will say is quite impossible. And if you know some of the countries involved, you'll declare, well, it's not conceivable from any point of view. But before you say things of that character, let your mind travel back over a few years. It's some while ago that Paul Henri Spaak, when he was Secretary General of NATO, said quite simply, we don't need any more committees in Europe. What Europe needs is a man. And he described the character of man he thought was required. Then Spaak, who has known an entity, said this, worse is a man to appear, were he God or devil, we'd give our power into the hands of that man. That is a way in which politicians are thinking today. You may travel to country after country in Western Europe, and you'll find the same reaction. We need leaders. We need someone to take control. I was in Brussels a few months ago, a country that virtually is composed of 2 countries, one Flemish-speaking and the other French-speaking. There's no binding force. They need someone, they say on every side, who's able to deal with the problems and to take control. A leader. Go to France, a marvelous country from many points of view, and despite all that is said of discard as tank, there's still the same cry. We need a leader, someone, to take control. In Italy, the same thing is being repeated. In Holland or the Netherlands, again, you'll find the same story. In my country, we have a lady in control. I dare not go any farther. But in country after country, there's a cry for a leader. Someone who's capable of dealing with the problems and difficulties and of providing the solution. If your mind travels back over history, you recall that over and over again, when conditions of that character have existed, the very circumstances have called forth the character of man who is required. My mind always goes back to the last war and to Sir Winston Churchill. Unquestionably, he was the man we needed at that moment. A man of strong personality, a man of a certain caliber, one who arose the nation and bound the people together. How he did it, I just don't know. But certainly, he was a man for the day. When his task was complete and the war was won, the populace threw him aside and put in the Labour Party. Let that be a lesson to you, too. But there he was when his work was needed. It's happened over and over again in history. When a man of a certain character was required, the very circumstances have called forth the man. Today, in Western Europe, we need a man. a leader, one of dynamic personality, one with the power to deal with financial and economic problems, one who can lead the people out of the morass. The need is vital and urgent. And if one looks back on past history, one would anticipate that in the fairly near future, such a man will arise, someone to take control. And 10 nations, fully integrated, will be under his authority. That's the kind of thing that the Bible talks about, both in Daniel and in Revelation. It refers to that man and to those 10 nations, both as the beast. That's rather a problem, isn't it? You have to read carefully to determine in Revelation whether John is talking about the person himself or about the vast company of nations over which he has control. There's a man with the control over 10 nations. A man who claims authority, not only in that field, but in another field as well. 70% of the population of the European community are Roman Catholic. Of course, there's only nominally so. There's a very large number of purely nominal Catholics. But a Catholic has an allegiance to the Church. And if there's a question of priority, the Church claims first priority. So that sooner or later, a conflict might come between the state and the Church. The Church already is speaking with a fairly loud voice. There is no doubt whatsoever that in the foreseeable future, that voice will be heard even more loudly in the councils of Europe. And eventually, the punch will come. One who's a strong character would unquestionably say, this situation is quite intolerable. An end must be put to interference from the Church. That might easily climax in something like the picture that is painted in Revelation chapter 17, where the political power, the 10 countries and their ruler, put a stop to the activities of the Church. That great universal Church is brought to an end and her wealth is looted. That kind of picture is already being shadowed forth in the conditions of the present day. So that one could say quite simply, what the Bible talks about might quite possibly be casting a shadow before. Now of course someone will say, doesn't Revelation 13 talk about individuals having a mark, some on the hand, and some on the forehead? I expect you have read some of those marvelous fantasies that are printed today about a laser beam marking your hand or marking your forehead, and all that kind of rubbish. I'm sorry, all that kind of stuff. Well, I don't think for a second the Revelation is talking about that kind of thing. Now I use my illustration again. If you're a worker, you would have to belong to your trade union. It will be a completely closed shop. That is rapidly coming in every one of those 10 countries. In my country, it applies almost universally today. One must be a member of the trade union or professional organization to secure a job. Otherwise, there's no job, no employment. That quite clearly is going to be implemented to the full in the not-too-distant future. Isn't that possibly the mark to which John refers? Of course, if you prefer to take it in a different way, he says quite deliberately, without that mark, whatever it may be, in hand or in forehead, it will be impossible to trade, to buy or to sell. You won't get a job, you won't be able to employ labor, you won't be able to buy food, and so on. This is not remote from the conditions that are visualized in the Rome Treaty in Western Europe today. So that possibly, I say again, what the Bible describes might be casting its shadow before. Look at the story as portrayed or told in the Bible. John states quite simply, that power or that superpower will seek worship as God. He went into the temple, says Paul, and proclaimed himself to be God. His statue erected at Jerusalem will be brought to life, and all will be commanded to worship that statue and the man whom it represents. There'll be a very strong incentive to do so, for the penalty for not doing so will be death. A very strong incentive indeed. And then there follows that terrible period to which we referred this afternoon, the Great Tribulation. But John also describes the end of that man. He means with his end at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. For the first two persons with whom our Lord deals at his second advent, at his return to earth, are the beast and the false prophet. This man, this great ruler, and his Jewish associates, and they're cast alive into the lake of fire. One who has tremendous authority, who exercises it apparently well in the first instance for 3.5 years, but then who becomes apostate, is judged by the devil himself, and ends in the lake of fire. And if you doubt the eternity of punishment, follow the history of those two men. For 1,000 years later, it refers to them as still being in the lake of fire. And that's the picture presented in the Bible. It's a picture that is gradually forming in our world today. I think one ought to stand sometimes and look around and see how things are going on in the world about us. See what trends and movements there are, and what the probable end of those trends may be. Today, one may look in that political sphere and see the possibilities of something like what the Bible describes. If that be so, if one can see a very clear resemblance, one is forced to a conclusion. It would be extremely difficult for another body to come into being of the same shape and character, so that it is quite probable, rather than quite possible, that what we are seeing might be that of which the Bible is speaking. Now again I say, don't go away and say I said this was that. I said no such thing. I only suggested a possibility or a probability. And it's up to you to make up your own mind as to whether there's anything in it. If one takes that assumption, if it does look as though what the Bible forecasts is gradually coming into being, then there's only one simple deduction that can be made. The end is in sight. The end of the Jewish age is about to start to reach its completion. But it cannot until you have gone. Until our Lord Jesus Christ has come to the earth and taken away those who belong to him. I look just at one small picture. We might have looked at picture after picture and might have seen how all the events described in prophecy, biblical prophecy, seem, and don't take a stronger view, but seem to be casting their shadow before. If that is so, if that is a fact, then quite clearly your departure is about to occur. And that's the real point. Current events have no real value to the Christian unless one can bring it into line with this. It seems to me that our Lord's coming for his church is about to occur. That very shortly we will hear his shout and the sound of the trumpet, and be caught up to meet him in the air. There is nothing to be fulfilled before that happens. No particular event awaiting fulfillment. So, putting it quite simply, there is no conceivable reason, from a purely human point of view, why our Lord Jesus Christ should not return this very day. And that's the whole point. Our Lord's coming may be just as close as that. You cannot talk today about centuries. I very much question whether you can talk about decades. What is happening speedily. Events are moving today far more rapidly than ever they have moved in history. And one picks up the paper day by day, or turns to television or the radio, and wonders what next is going to happen. The events are crowding in, and the whole picture painted in prophecy seems gradually to be forming. It seems no possible doubt that our end is in sight, and that very soon our Lord will come, and we will be gone. That's the event for which we wait. That's the whole purpose of our studying prophecy. It revolves around Him, the glorious future of our blessed Lord, His marvelous reign upon earth, the wonderful realization of all the promises to His people. He's coming. He might come just as soon as today. Well, I say once more, now don't misinterpret what has been said. I've just painted a picture drawn from current events and compared it very roughly, extremely roughly in fact, with what the Bible predicts as well. There does seem to be a resemblance. I've not said that this was that. All I've done is to use an illustration.